With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got all the essentials for comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style you can count on. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and effortless looks. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25.
This is the D Word Podcast, where we talk dementia. Welcome along to another D Word Podcast. My guest on this edition is Susan Stasiak, whose own experience being a dementia caregiver has led to her to use the skills that she gained as a corporate trainer to write a book, Caring for the Caregiver's Mind. Well, Susan, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the D Word as my guest. Plenty to talk about, caring for the caregiver's mind. A lot of this stuff and really important things come from people's personal experience. And obviously you've had very much personal experience as a caregiver, which you've now turned into advice for other caregivers. I mean, tell us a little bit, first of all, about, you know, your whole personal experience.
Sure. I was a 7-year full-time spousal caregiver for my life partner, Chuck, who already had congestive heart failure, but it was very mild at the time that we met 25 years earlier, and or probably 18 years earlier. And so he was pretty active and healthy. And then one day he got the diagnosis of Alzheimer's. And that's how we got started. First with the Alzheimer's, a year later, he got a diagnosis of COPD. And that really shut him down in terms of activity. We were tennis players. We were playing tennis up to the second diagnosis of COPD. So started to get to almost just very limited in terms of what we could do as a couple. So that whole social life went out the window. And it was disorienting and discouraging at first.
It's going to throw you into a whole new world, isn't it? But, you know, before Chuck was diagnosed, what kind of led you to wanting a diagnosis in the first place?
Before he was diagnosed, what led me?
Were there any signs or, you know?
Actually, I didn't really have too many signs. My daughter said she did after the fact. She just noticed things were off. And I heard Chuck talking about his friends at coffee hour. He'd go to coffee with his guy friends, and they would laugh about drawing maps on their napkins at the maps on how to get home. So I just thought it was, you know, a bunch of retired men that are making fun of their old age. Until one day, Chuck told me that his physician, his primary physician, diagnosed him with Alzheimer's. And I suspect, in hindsight, that that diagnosis had happened probably a few months, maybe 5 months before he actually told me. And the reason I say that is Chuck never made anything out. He never exaggerated anything. He wanted to, you know, kind of keep things quiet, especially about his health. So, because he already had some challenges with the COPD. So he, he didn't tell me at first, but when he told me, I was like, oh my gosh, it didn't matter at that point. I didn't ask him, why didn't you tell me? It didn't matter. It mattered, of course, that I heard it and reacted to it. That's with tears in my eyes and this whole idea of, oh my gosh, it's like cancer. It's like a death sentence. And I thought, I knew nothing except hearsay about dementia. So my mind went way out there. And that's not a good thing, of course. That was the beginning of my stress.
Yeah, and that's a, I guess that's a natural reaction to initially getting that kind of news. I mean, that was what you thought. You said he was with his friends and drawing maps on napkins and stuff. What was their reaction when they knew?
I think they were maybe not surprised. I didn't talk to them individually about that. I knew after a short while that Chuck was going to have, after the diagnosis, I could see that some of his ability to handle things went down. In fact, we had what I call for my book an inciting incident where he was coming in to the driveway, and instead of slowing down and putting his foot on the brake, he put his foot on the gas and went flying through the side yard into the backyard over some mulch, bags of mulch, which was very, I mean, he took out the neighbor's fence post, he ripped out some of the forsythia bush. And like we were both in shock. I happened to be in the front yard gardening. So that was what I call the inciting incident when I met dementia face to face.
Yeah, I think almost made it head on, I think, in that description. You've turned all that. You mentioned your book. We'll kind of open the cover in a minute. But what prompted you, having gone all through that, to put it in writing and lay it open so other people can see it? Some people might have thought, well, I don't really want everybody to know about this.
Yes, I was reluctant at first to even talk to my neighbors about the dementia diagnosis, but I had started to write some speeches I gave in my Toastmasters group as a kind of cathartic activity for myself. And it was a very, I tended to be very uplifting about it, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And somebody in the group, our Toastmasters group, said, "You should write a book." And I thought, yeah, that's a great idea. Little did I know how difficult it was. So I started taking notes along the way, and I asked Chuck at one point, "Do you mind if I write about us?" And he said, "No problem." So I started writing about what was going on, and then I remembered once I got into my own frustration and angst and disorientation, I realized I know how to deal with me. I had for t over 20 years taught in the workplace how to improve performance based on what I call cognitive behavioral therapy and practices and emotional intelligence. But when that first came upon me, I had no idea to use that. I was just enmeshed in the emotional swings, the up and down, and just what do I have to do, and how, what caregiving groups do I need to go to, and where can I find information? So I was enmeshed in all of that, and I needed some clarity, some distance. And so after I'd say that probably after a year and a half or so, I started to gain some traction with myself about calming myself down. And one of the things I realized as I did research was stress is the biggest problem with caregivers. in my estimation. In fact, our National Institute of Health here in the US talks about 18 to 21%, maybe more, of caregivers with dealing with dementia die before their care recipients die. 18 to 21, and other places cite higher levels. So that stress is cumulative, especially with dementia, because of the erratic, disoriented, and illogical actions. And then a spousal caregiver, especially, but definitely other family members that you may be caring for, there's this bonding, and that bonding changes. And so you have the loss, you have the increase in stress, and then you have the tasks of taking care of that person. So that's heavy emotionally, mentally, physically.
The station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
The UK Health Radio Awards are with us once again. There is a dementia support category with five nominees chosen for their outstanding work in the field. The winner will be decided by your votes. So keep watching UKHealthRadio.com for details of how you can get involved. On this edition, I'm chatting to dementia carer and author Susan Stasiak. Yeah, you know, it certainly is. And, you know, I guess you have to get used to a life role change in the fact you've been a partner for so long, but suddenly you become a caregiver. You know, a lot of people that I speak to, a lot of organisations I speak to about caregivers say that people don't always admit they are, you know, that they've changed. They are a caregiver.
Yes, the stigma was definitely, I didn't realize I had that. I thought I was, you know, I thought I was pristine in that area and open-minded, but I really did have some stigma about mental neurological disorder because I noticed how I spoke readily about Chuck's congestive heart failure to my friends and acquaintances, but I sort of hesitated at first. And I realized that's not good because I need to be okay with it. And it took a while. It took a while for me to see it as something that, you know, a stigma for our social life, a stigma for my life, his life. And then I started seeing the good in it. But it took a while. And that's part of what the book portrays, the change in thinking and examining the beliefs that I had before I changed, decided I needed to change. So,
yeah, that's, you know, that's an important message and good for people to read who may be going through that and realizing that some of the things that you have put down in print are natural and things that they are going through. Because, you know, one of the things must be when you become a caregiver with that kind of diagnosis, nothing you said, you know, right at the beginning, it's kind of almost panic mode and don't know what to do. And, you know, I think what you said also about COPD, I spent a career in public health and heard loads about COPD, diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. I didn't hear a word about dementia. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they're all diseases. So that stigma, sadly, you know, sadly is still attached and obviously causes a lot of stress.
I think there's a generational issue there as well as a cultural issue with the stigma. And as the younger generation comes on, like the millennials who are the sandwich generation, they're taking care of their parents as well as their children and still working, that they're a little more open about that. And about everything, actually, about emotions they're open about. So I think that is going to help, but it doesn't change the number of hours and days and years that a caregiver and the number of caregivers that need to happen because dementia is, coming forward quickly and increasing worldwide, along with mental health. So there's two set of crises happening at the same time throughout the world. And the caregiver's mental health is pivotal point because if he or she, the caregiver, cannot help in the family, then who's going to take care of? So that's why the prevention is more important on that realm, if possible.
Yeah, do you? I mean, do you think in terms of dementia, maybe we do it with other illnesses, but we certainly do it with dementia. We concentrate on the person who's got the condition, which is great, all well and good. Don't get me wrong, but in doing that, the caregiver gets left behind because they're very much secondary to the person that's got the diagnosis.
Yes, in fact, that when I did my research for the book that I thought I would create, there was a lot of information about the behavior of the person with dementia and how to deal with it, how to not cause more frustration on the patient's part, which is good. And then there was a little information about the caregiver taking care of herself or himself by way of lifestyle changes. Make sure you eat well, make sure you sleep well, make sure. This is kind of, I'm laughing, sleep well, right? Exercise, take a walk, all of that, which I am that's important to me. I did a great deal of that. I still played tennis and I still tried to, and Chuck understood that. He actually did not end up having Alzheimer's. He ended up having vascular dementia. So he had a little more lucidity than someone with Alzheimer's. However, what wasn't yet out there when I did the research was this whole idea of handling our minds that are causing our stress, the caregiver's mind. There's a lot of self-inflicted situations that we see things as a caregiver in one way, like I expressed at the beginning of my journey. I thought it was terrible, was it? And that caused stress. And as I learned about it, I was taking action, reducing my stress, going to places where there were other caregivers in caregiving groups, telling me and everyone in the group how they're handling and what issues I might come upon in the future. So all of that helped to minimize this initial stress. But then, of course, we have stress with our family, with our families. Some of them want to be a part of our journey, and some of them don't. I had a friend who is a very good friend who didn't want to participate in that at all. And there were other reasons, but I really kept that resentment for a while and realized I'm hurting myself with that. So in one of my chapters, I talk about expectations, even though it's logical that your good friend would help you, that doesn't always happen, or that your family members should help you, but that doesn't always happen. So how did I handle that? And I had to start with my foibles and my mistakes to be relatable. And then I showed and through reflection and dialogue and narrative how I got myself out of that situation. So for me, this is a teaching memoir in that not only do they learn about my life, they learn about how I used my thinking and exploration and curiosity to dig deeper into the cause of my stress in that particular situation, and probably about 20 other situations for the 20 chapters that I wrote.
I mean, there was a phrase, you use your mind without letting it use you, which, I think is a bit of a mantra, really, isn't it? And important. But again, like everything like that, it's easy to say it, but when you're in the middle of it, it takes some courage, stamina, etc., to actually achieve it.
Yes, and that's the rationale for the actual story about that. What maybe the several different things, as I suggested, that are typical caregiving struggles. And they read the story and they understand how I got out of that problem. And hopefully they learn from my mistakes. So that's. But I dive deep into an analysis without being, it's still very light, but I try to explain about why I might be feeling this way and if that belief is valid today. Because there were times when I had beliefs like the one about the stigma that weren't valid. And so I had to push it down deep into my psyche to learn how to do that. And that's actually how I worked with the workplace folks years before when there was conflict. That's always a big one in the workplace, right? When there was conflict, I suggested it wasn't just that person across the way that was giving you challenge. What's your part in it? And they, what do you mean? But if we can learn to take responsibility for our reactions to whatever's gone on out here, we have some control over our minds. If we blame only, we have no control. We become the victim and they're in power. Not that they know it, they're in power, but we're not powered at all. We have given our power away by blaming the other person.
Yeah, and one of the important things you said was learning by mistakes. That I talk to caregivers, and one of the important messages is you're not going to get everything right. Everybody makes mistakes. You're thrust into a new world, so it's not going to be perfect.
Yes, the mistakes are actually the learning curve. How would we know we're progressing? And some of the learnings are tough. So it's not a, oh, I need to do it this way. We have to really identify what are the thoughts here? What are the beliefs that are making me react very strongly against anything that might come up? Just recently edited one of the chapters in which I walked into Chuck's room, and it was probably about a midpoint in the dementia journey with him. And I walked in the morning and said, "Good morning." And he was totally staring, and he was totally out of it. And that was a shock to me because I had not seen that before. But interestingly enough, I caught my, he said, "Good morning." And finally he answered, he said, "What time is it?" And I thought he could see that the light was, there was a sunlight outside. And I thought he could see that through the blinds, the cracks in the blinds, but he couldn't. And I got upset about that and made a sarcastic remark back to him. And then, because I'm tuned in to guilt, I explain how guilt was a help because I felt guilty. And sometimes guilt helps me identify something's wrong with my values here and my actions. So I processed that and realized when I was a kid, it sometimes does happen, that our experiences as children, we think of things in a certain way, and it's not true for today. When I was a kid, my parents and teachers wanted me to be good at school. So they, you know, encouraged me to be good at school. Well, as a child, being good at school meant always being right because the teacher would test you and ask you questions. And if you were right, you were getting a better grade. And so a child's mind is very concrete and interprets that I have to be right. And then, of course, I have to have my children be right and my loved ones be right. And I just automatically shot out a sarcastic remark to Chuck because he wasn't right. That is, I know it's a deep dive, but where the heck did I get that from? Because I know better as an adult that mistakes are part of our growth. But as a child, I didn't know that. Nobody told me that. Now, the parenting is a little bit better today than it was. But, you know, being good at school meant being right. And I carried that, and that belief is not helpful today, right?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
On UK Health Radio, we have over 40 shows covering every aspect of health. All the shows are available for listen again and download from the website ukhealthradio.com. My guest on this edition of the podcast is dementia advocate and author Susan Stasiak. Absolutely, but you know, you can see, as you've explained, where it comes from. And, you know, I think it's interesting. I guess the one thing caregivers will, you know, need to do and will say is that to have this kind of reflection, as you did then, you've got to actually take yourself aside and give yourself a bit of time to do that and come back to the guilt word. That, I guess, is where people feel guilty where they shouldn't.
Yeah. And, but it's a, in some cases, guilt is a help. It's an emotion that's not trying to hurt you. It's trying to show you something's wrong. That's when it's good. There are other forms of guilt that come up, that came up for me, that really I had nothing to do with. There's no background from my childhood or anything. It was what I thought a cultural norm that we in our culture believe without being taught. We pick up that caregivers are people who do well at caregiving. And so, who generally does well at caregiving? Females. So, there's this unconscious acceptance that females do well at caregiving. And so, we put that on ourselves individually and think, I'm a caregiver, I'm his wife, I should do this. And when I'm not doing it, or I'm not doing it perfectly, which kind of is another problem from my background, then there's guilt. But that kind of guilt, the cultural norm guilt from our culture, is not, we're pure there. We don't, we can see, I'm not going to accept that today, or I will accept it, but on my terms. Now, the reflection time for me was generally short. There was a couple of ones that I really needed because I'm used to using this. But it's very simple. The cognitive behavioral practices are simple. In fact, when I was doing this research to see who else was might be doing that in the book, the only thing I found was 2019, what was this? Stanford University research by four researchers for caregivers, mental health, and they suggested to use their, after they went through their research, they suggested to use cognitive behavioral training for paraprofessionals so the paraprofessionals can go out and train. Well, I was already using it, so I knew it was simplistic enough. It's just a shift. What's different, though, in what I'm offering is I was there personally, and I show that example that is very, very relevant to the probably to the caregiver. These are typical but very challenging caregiving examples that happen all the time in my mind, in my experience. So it's not too difficult, and researchers are suggesting that it would be just fine.
Yeah, it seems very logical to use that type of approach. I guess the kind of the D word dementia thing gets in the way a little bit because people tend to go down the medical route and forget all kinds of social interactions, which can be absolutely as important. And from a caregiver's perspective, I suppose it's trying to get some control over an uncontrollable situation because, as you said earlier, you don't know what's going to happen. So, it's trying to keep some control in there.
That is actually the only thing we do have control over is our mind. We have choices, and with a little bit of practice, we can understand ourselves better. And I know people probably have done this without even knowing they have done this, maybe in the workplace, when they're learning a new tool or new situation. They're doing that. They're working with themselves. So it's not an unusual thing. It's just not at this point out in the public, so to speak, for people to be able to relate to it. And I hope that, and there's plenty, if there were six books like this, that would not be enough, right? There's plenty of work to be done. But here's the coolest thing. This works in every aspect of our lives. Imagine if we really could get agency over our emotions. We wouldn't have as much conflict, at least on a personal level. And I think for me, that's really a very spiritual principle to have control over myself so I can make better choices.
Yeah, I think you've explained it kind of perfectly there. Nuts and bolts about the book. I mean, when can we get one?
I would love to know that answer. I'm looking for a publisher. I'm doing my edits right now, third or four edits, at three or four, different edits over the book, putting one chapter in this place and another over here and adding this. So I'm still working on that, which I want it to be as good as it can be. I'm working with a couple of editors myself, and we have a proposal. 40-page proposal that shows what it's about, and that's you have to do that with nonfiction. Our competition, the two issues I talked about with mental health as well as the emotional mental health of the caregiver. And what else is going on? So I don't know. I'm hoping soon I can
Okay.
keep you posted for sure.
Yeah, please do because I very much look forward to it because there are a lot of books, but as you say about this particular subject, if there are 100 books out there, there are probably not enough because it's not a subject that's to the fore. A lot of people I talk to, and what I said earlier in the conversation is concentrate on the condition, how to react to the condition, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's vital that people like you actually are willing to share their experience so other people can learn.
I actually feel like it's a calling. Once I got rolling, I started looking back over my life and I thought, wow, this situation led to this situation, which led to this situation. And I had these tools that helped me a lot. And I have presented in person and over podcasts and webinars already, and in the last since 2019, just to test out my ideas. And it's been wonderful. People are very receptive, and I'm thrilled. So hopefully, sooner rather than later.
Very much hope so. I mean, Susan, we're bees out of the same pod because that's the reason how I've ended up talking about dementia on the radio. But that's a story for another day because we're running out of time. But do keep in touch. Let us know when the book's coming out. And just thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you, Pete. I really appreciate that. And I love what you're doing. I really do. I think it's great. You're part of that movement forward.
Thanks to Susan, and I wish her every success with the book, Caring for the Caregiver's Mind. You can find out more on her website at susanstasiak.com. Well, that's it for this edition. Thanks for your company, and I hope you'll join me again soon for some more dementia talk right here on the D Word Podcast.